think for a second about the glue that holds your life together. It might be your family, your friends, making enough money so you can get your bills paid, or it could be something bigger, social contract, society-level stuff. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, as I was thinking about our show, I realized we have a ton of stories about what holds us together. Literally, with a really cool interview about wooden skyscrapers, which are becoming a thing. Somewhat figuratively, with conversations about healthcare, food, and rock and roll. And societally, in the legislation we pass and the policies we adopt. Oh, and I'm going to tell a story about the one time I thought I had a botfly in Brazil. Anyway, come talk to us anytime at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We are starting the show, as we do most weeks, with our long and short segment. That's where we borrow some terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and apply it to the world of news. This week, we've got Marketplace's own Andy Euler and Kimberly Adams. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hey, Lizzie.
I would like to start with Kimberly's long. Tell us what you're long on, Ms. Washington correspondent.
I am long on fast-moving congressional legislation, and this is a shock for many of us here because usually we see congressional legislation moving at a glacial pace because it goes through all of these committees and it gets debated and it gets marked up and it gets sent back and back and forth and back and forth, and then it goes to the White House where it's knocked down and the president vetoes it or whatever happens. We don't see Congress moving a lot of legislation that actually changes massive policies all that quickly. And Congress was designed to do just that, to move at a more a slower pace so that things that need to be changed are changed in a thoughtful way. Well, now what we have is we have Republican control of Congress, of the White House, and soon of the Supreme Court. And we also have this backlog of legislation from 6 years of a GOP-controlled Congress that has been vetted, it's been thought about. The Republicans in the House and the Senate have had time to work out all the details. So there's just this stockpile of legislation and goals that the Republicans have that come January 20th, they're going to have probably someone who we expect as much as you can expect anything from the Trump administration to be amenable. And so I think we're going to see the legislation coming out of Congress and approved by the White House come fast and furious, which is going to keep all of us here in Washington on our toes.
Is there any sort of things that, you know, the few folks on the left hand of the left side of the aisle can do procedurally? I mean, are there, you know,
or are
there
things they agree with?
Right. Sure.
Well, what they can do is they can make a lot of noise. We're seeing from Bernie Sanders and the Democrats in both the House and Senate and all of the sort of think tanks and advocacy groups are really trying to do sort of public awareness campaigns because honestly, their options in Congress are pretty limited. They don't want to get the label that they've given to the Republicans the past few years of just being, you know, the party of no or the party of obstruction or something like that, where they're just using all of these archaic maneuvers in Congress just to stop legislation from moving. You know, believe it or not, I think one of the best opportunities for the Democrats moving forward is going to be on the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, because the Republicans are set on repealing it. They have a plan to repeal it. But when it comes to replacing it, I think that might be an opportunity for Democrats because millions and millions of people have health care who didn't, and they will not be pleased with Republicans if that is taken away with nothing to replace it. So that may be an opportunity for them.
You know, we're thinking about sort of the macro policy stuff here. Kimberly, you're looking at it from a Washington standpoint. Andy, you have kind of an international policy piece that I actually think fits interestingly into certainly the energy policy of the Trump administration.
No, I think you're right. I'm actually long on the deregulation of Mexican energy and the energy market in Mexico. It started about 3 years ago because forever, 75 years, there was a monopoly by Pemex in terms of who could go in and essentially drill for and then distribute oil and gasoline in Mexico. Now, we've heard about it, and the reason I've been thinking about it a lot this week is the start of the year brought about 20% spikes in gas prices in Mexico because they decided to deregulate the retail gasoline market. So there are two sort of different things happening here. They decided, look, we're not going to apply all of these subsidies for retail gas, so it's going to cost essentially what the market says it's going to cost, and that's about a quarter more than it was just a week ago. So now they're having protests in Mexico about it. The thing I think, though, this is why I'm long on it. I think
Are you long, man?
come on. Yeah, people are protesting. What are you doing? So the reason I'm long on this is because I think deregulation is the right move. Letting the markets decide what you should pay for energy, what you should pay for electricity and even gasoline, I think is the right move. What Mexico isn't maybe necessarily thinking about right now is how quickly they're doing it. So this was President Enrique Peña Nieto said it was going to take 2018 to impose this deregulation of the retail gasoline market. And then he decided, you know what, I'm going to push it up because we have elections next year. So I'm going to show folks that we're, you know, making plans, we're taking action, and then it's going to eventually come out ahead. What's happening right now, though, is he's not winning any favors with anybody because they're paying way more for gas. It's going to take a lot longer, I think, than the president thinks about when you have an election the next year. But I think in the long term, deregulation in the Mexican energy market is the way to go.
All right. I want to switch from this sort of big picture policy to companies because each of you are short specific corporations. Kimberly, you go first.
I am short on Sears Holding Corporation, the owner of Sears and Kmart, which announced this week that it would close another 150 stores on top of the several dozen stores it had previously announced were going to be closed. I mean, these big stores, these anchor stores in the malls just aren't doing well. And they've got a new line of credit. They're selling off their big brand.
From their own CEO.
Right.
Right. From their own CEO. And they're selling off the Craftsman brand, which is like its iconic brand. It's been around for like a century and, you know, trying to prop up this, you know, this big, big name, but I really don't know that it's going to work. I mean, when was the last time either of you were in a Sears? Another reason why I'm short on Sears is because of what its brand is built upon. I mean, if you think about it, Sears, you conjure up the images of people in their garages doing home improvement projects and, you know, doing stuff around these sort of big homes that a lot of Americans just don't have anymore. So you have increasing urbanization and people are shopping more online and, you know, you're not necessarily buying your dad a toolkit for Christmas anymore. I have to think that Sears is one of those companies that's struggling to redefine itself as the country and its shopping habits change.
Absolutely. I mean, I was given a toolkit by my parents when I, you know, left college and went out into the world. It was sort of, here you go to take care of yourself. That was 1998. So, you know, things are different now. All right, Andy, you are also short a company. Tell us about it.
I am short a company, and I feel, you know, the little kid in me is super bummed out because I hung out here a lot eating Happy Meals. I'm short on McDonald's. There are some analysts that think that Starbucks is actually going to take over as the most valued restaurant chain, and they're going to take it over from McDonald's. Are they the Sears of fast food? Are they doing the same thing they've always kind of done? I just don't think McDonald's is sort of thinking about, okay, what do we need to be doing 10, 15, 20 years? Because things are still working. I mean, after all, they are still the world's most valuable restaurant chain as of now. I'm just kind of short on them because I don't think they're thinking 10, 20, 30 years out.
I'm going to disagree with you on this short, Andy, because McDonald's doesn't need us here in the United States who want our fancy coffee and who want our healthy eating options because, you know, I spent a lot of time in the developing world before moving to Washington. And McDonald's are popping up everywhere and people love them and they go to them as like a destination. It's a date restaurant.
Sure.
It's where you take your family on a Saturday afternoon as a treat. And in many parts of the world, they are thinking pretty far ahead. They're tailoring their menus and really promoting it as sort of the American ideal. Get yourself a McDonald's franchise and you can work your way up the ladder and live the American dream, even if your country doesn't necessarily have the structures for social and economic mobility. The middle classes in many developing countries are just booming, and they love them some McDonald's.
If Americans just stop eating at McDonald's, that would hurt, I imagine. But you think they could still surprise?
I am skeptical that Americans are going to stop eating at
right.
McDonald's.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Marketplace's Andy Euler and Kimberly Adams, thank you both very much.
No, thank you, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Secret that we like to do the numbers here at Marketplace. It's kind of our thing. So let's dig into a few of them with our producers Tony Wagner and Cerise Castle as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$91.7 billion.
That's the final tally for online sales over the holidays, up double digits from 2015.
Meanwhile, a number of department stores and booksellers reported low earnings this week.
Barnes & Noble even lost the boost it had selling coloring books for grown-ups.
That fad's done in 2017. You heard it here first.
5.8 million.
That's how many returns UPS says it'll process this week.
After all that online shopping, plenty of gifts are going back, and retailers will give up some of the money they made last month.
The good news is, when customers make a return, they're likely to buy something else from the same store. 13.2 hours.
That's how long it took the richest American CEOs to earn what the average worker will make in 2017.
Quartz crunched the numbers using data from Bloomberg and a British think tank that tracks top earners.
The only country with a bigger divide between executives and average workers was South Africa, where CEOs earned the average annual salary there in just over 7 hours.
Happy New Year!
When you think of Savannah, Georgia, one of the images in your mind is likely its giant live oak trees draped in Spanish moss. But in October, Hurricane Matthew knocked down hundreds of trees. The storm cost Savannah and the surrounding county upwards of $35 million in damage and cleanup. Now, Savannah is in the process of pulling itself back together, and some residents are trying to put those downed trees to good use before they end up in the wood chipper. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Emily Jones reports.
At a large open lot in Savannah, trucks full of branches and logs line up waiting to be counted. Once it's checked in, the debris gets unloaded onto a growing pile.
And then that material gets put through the grinder, and we process it into mulch, and we stockpile the mulch.
Down Knight works for Ashbrit, a company that does cleanup all over the country. He's managing the operation here. His company has gathered more than 1 million cubic yards of storm debris, including many large old trees, some dating back a century or more. That got Brandy Mai, a longtime resident of the Savannah area, thinking that at least some of the trees shouldn't become mulch.
A lot of these trees have as much history as the town itself. They've seen fires. They've seen war. They've seen so many things. I know it's crazy to personify a tree as such, but these trees are just as much a part of Savannah's history as anything else.
So she started a Facebook group after the storm and quickly found she wasn't alone. Posts poured in from others hoping to do something with their downed trees. The group helped residents find local sawmills and woodworkers like Charlie Ward.
What I've been doing is taking a can out of the top and quarter sawing that, and then a couple thicker slabs out of the middle.
He starts to saw through a piece of hickory. For Ward and his wife Sarah, the mill is a fledgling business, what she describes as their startup, Slovana Farms. They're hoping to sell a lot of this wood as lumber for about $3 to $4 a foot. That's comparable to a home improvement store because they're getting most of the trees for free in exchange for hauling them away. They estimate they'll get about 10,000 feet of lumber from the Hurricane Matthew trees. So far, they've had a fair amount of interest. And not only because the wood costs about the same as commercial lumber, but also because of what buyers can make with it.
Well, it's something special, something you don't just buy at IKEA or Walmart. And you gotta have a memory of it.
Bart Haig, a carpenter who's helping mill the wood, brushes off the freshly cut piece and points out its unique features.
You can see right now why that's such nice furniture wood. That nice dark brown in the middle with the contrast with the white, just absolutely beautiful.
He'll use slabs like the one they just cut for furniture, tabletops and legs, benches, countertops. One of those benches can sell for $500, while custom tables run about $3,000. A large tree can produce about 10 tables. But it will be a while before they see that kind of money. All this wood has to dry for 6 months to a year before it's ready to use. In the meantime, local businesses have gotten some storm souvenirs ready for gifts. Haig is selling coasters and cheese boards for $30 a piece. He says they're pretty popular.
Oh, gosh, yes, a lot more than I had ever expected. My wife suggested doing this, and then all of a sudden I find myself making hundreds of sets of these.
Coasters aren't his favorite project, but business is business. And Haig says making something out of the downed trees is important.
You've got to do what you got to do. The trees are down now. I'm sad they're down, but we've got to utilize them or it's even sadder.
He says he's got a long list of people waiting to get some piece of the trees that fell in their yards. In Savannah, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
You just heard a story about what to do with downed trees. We have another story about wood now. How would you feel about walking into a wooden skyscraper? Yes, these are a very real thing and not a relic of the past, but a new kind of building using high-tech wood and a sort of glue. It's called cross-laminated timber, or CLT. The buildings are popping up in Scandinavia, among other places. Justin Davidson wrote about them for New York Magazine, and we brought him on. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
I read this story and I was like, wait, seriously, what? Wood skyscrapers? How in the world would that work?
Well, we've been building with wood since time immemorial, so it's not a new material. But the technology of using wood has changed enough that you really can build very high buildings and make them out of wood. But the key is the manufacturing process. That's where the new technology comes in. So it's really...
Yeah, explain that to me.
Yeah, so it's really about taking wood from relatively young trees. So we're not talking about big, thick logs necessarily. It's managed forests. You take relatively small units of wood when they're sawn boards, but you're then gluing them together into these massive units. So the general term for this is mass timber. Mass timber has two basic components. One is CLT, cross-laminated timber, which is these huge boards, essentially, made up of smaller boards.
How big are we talking about?
They could be 8 to 12 inches thick.
Oh, wow.
So that's a thick piece of super plywood and 10 feet wide, 40 feet long. So, you know, basically one of those would give you a lane of a bowling alley.
Yeah. And so you take those and then you use the phrase in here almost like a really kind of high-tech Amish barn raising.
The thing about this and the other kind of mass timber is called glue lam, which is basically the same idea, except you're making beams and columns out of it instead of boards. The great advantage to it is that you can manipulate it in a factory using computer-controlled milling and do all the openings that you need, cut out the windows, cut out channels, and pre-design and then pre-manufacture these units that can then be quickly assembled on site. So in a funny way, it's a real realization of the dream of prefabrication. Hmm. If you think about it, buildings, even the tallest, highest tech buildings, we still basically make those the same way people built cathedrals in the Middle Ages. You got a guy up there, you know, on a scaffolding. Okay, now he's welding steel or they're pouring concrete and the wind's howling across the slab. If you could take more of the manufacture of these components and do them in a climate-controlled factory floor, it means that you can do all of the preparations there. And then when you're on site, this is a simplified way of putting it, but you're essentially clipping it together like a kit. So it's a kit of parts that comes on the truck. Now, the idea of prefabricating buildings or in large parts, you know, that's also an old idea. And we're starting to see tall buildings done with, you know, prefabricated units. But this is kind of somewhere in between. It's prefabricating a lot of the panels, which is a standard construction technique, but so many of them that you can then really assemble the building very quickly.
And this is actually being done at least a little bit in Scandinavia?
Oh, it's being done all over the world, and it's being done in increasingly large buildings. The tallest one that's in the works now is 21 stories in Amsterdam. So they're gradually building larger and larger buildings, and the question is, what's the theoretical upper limit? Some architects I talk to will say sort of it stops being efficient and really making sense around 15, 20 stories. One architect, Michael Green, who's a big proselytizer of this technology, has said really there's no inherent limit. He had proposed a 34-story tower for Paris, was not built, but, you know, is theoretically possible. So it really comes down to efficiency and cost.
You came here to our office on, you know, 3rd Avenue in New York City, walking through like a canyon of steel and glass buildings. Why build out of wood when you could do it that way?
So one reason is environmental. To create concrete and steel, which are the two primary structural materials, is tremendously polluting. You're pumping out carbon into the atmosphere as you do that. The creation of wood is solar powered, right? The sun grows the trees for you. Then you've got these trees, and as we know, they store carbon. And the only time that wood, the trees, release carbon is when they either burn or rot. So if you let a tree fall in a forest and rot and disintegrate, it's going to slowly release that carbon back into the atmosphere. If you take that same tree and preserve it in construction, in a building, it's warehousing that carbon. So essentially, for a ton of steel, you're producing something like a ton and a half of carbon. For a ton of wood, you're warehousing carbon. So the difference in carbon emissions is actually much bigger.
And the cutting down of trees?
Well, you're not cutting old growth forest. You're not deforesting the Amazon. These are managed forests. So you're planting the trees, you're letting them grow 10, 15 years, and then you harvest them. And actually, one theory is that essentially this is self-sustaining and self-capitalizing, because if there's a demand for construction-grade wood in the United States and in Europe and around the world, what you're doing is pumping money into the forestry business. And that allows you to manage the forest better, to manage fires, to plant more trees, to cull the trees that are not healthy, that are creating underbrush, and so on.
One thing that immediately jumps into my mind, and you mentioned this in your piece, is there was a time in America, certainly around the turn of the century, where we built everything out of wood, and cities like San Francisco went up in flames.
Burned, yeah. If you think about making a fire in your fireplace, you don't put a great big log on the fireplace and then hold a match to it, right? Because nothing's going to happen. What you do is you build up the fire using smaller kindling twigs and so on. So essentially, CLT is like that big log. It will burn, as will every other material, but it will burn slowly and in a predictable way and evenly, essentially giving residents time to escape and firefighters time to respond. And they've done a lot of tests with this. I mean, this is a well-tested material.
Tested for earthquakes as well.
Tested for earthquakes, tested for fire. It's evolving and more testing has to be done and every city has its own code and so on. So there's an ongoing testing process. But if you build with it correctly, it has a fire resistance that's equivalent to concrete and steel.
What's the biggest barrier to this becoming widespread?
Habit. I mean, the construction industry is very routinized, and especially in a place like New York where the costs are so high, where the unions are powerful, and where, you know, you can put up two or three floors a week and the trades come in, you know, one after the other. It's a real sort of choreography of construction. So when you're talking about changing the way you do it, there's a startup cost that's significant. But you also have to kind of vertically integrate the whole thing so that you are bringing the logs or the boards into a manufacturing center that is going to put in raw lumber in one end, maybe even just like tree trunks, and produce building components out the other. The benefit is that it allows architects to design at a much greater level of detail just sitting at their desk at the computer, because essentially what they're doing is creating instructions that a milling machine will then perform on the board itself. But it's a different kind of design. It's a different kind of integration of the design process and the manufacturing process. And then it's a different kind of relationship between the manufacturers of the components and the people who are actually putting the building up. So all those relationships are very hard to change.
Justin Davidson, architecture critic for New York Magazine, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight to answer questions about work and money, what holds their lives together, or the lessons they've learned along the way. Here's producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
How do you do? This is the smooth dude with the gangster groove, Mayor Hawthorne, in the place to be.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Ooh, man, that's tough. Touring is really, really tough on your body. And a lot of my friends, like when I come into town, you know, my friends in other cities, other parts of the world, and they'll say, hey, man, I heard you coming into town. You know, when, how long are you going to be here? And, you know, can we get up next Friday? And I'll be like, yo, you don't get it, man. I'm coming in today. We're doing the show today, and we're in another city tomorrow. We're gone. So we don't, you know, you don't make any money on a day off hanging out.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
This is a great question. Like, I have a rule with clothes. If I have not worn it in a year, then I get rid of it. But it was probably some article of clothing, like a pair of jorts or something that I was just like, man, what was I thinking here?
When did you realize you can make an actual living off of music?
It wasn't for a while. When I first moved to LA, I was DJing, you know, just taking whatever kind of DJ gigs I could just to keep myself afloat. And then even when I signed my first record deal with Stone's Throw here and I put my first single out, and it did pretty well. And it was still a while after that before I could actually, like, quit my regular job. And I was doing graphic design and stuff and, you know, really just Detroit hustler mentality, you know, anything I could get to make a couple bucks to buy a burrito.
Do you remember your first DJ gig? How it went?
And my first DJ gig was definitely some kind of like house party at the University of Michigan on campus. And I was probably terrible. I'm sure I was awful. When I got my first pair of turntables, like in high school, I locked myself in my room for like a summer and I really just like worked at it all summer long because I did not want to suck. I was, you know, really inspired by guys like Disco D, amazingly skillful with it. And I didn't want to suck, man. I was like, I need to be that good.
How'd your parents react when you told them, this is what I was going to do now?
Well, my dad still plays bass guitar and sings in a band in Michigan to this day. So he did it back then, and he knew how incredibly difficult it was to make a living at it. So he always told me, you know, make sure you got, you know, you're going to go to college and you're going to get a degree and you're going to have something to fall back on. But he was always encouraging of me, you know, when I wanted to do it. My parents are my biggest fans for sure.
What was your first job?
One of the first jobs that I can really remember that I had when I was a teen was I drove the little tractor at the golf driving range that picked up the golf balls, and everybody would try to tag me, and I drove that thing around, and and I had picked up the golf balls. That was one of my first jobs.
In the next life, what would your career be?
I would probably be some kind of handyman. Like, I'd probably be the dude that comes to your house to fix your washer and dryer or something. My dad owned a hardware store growing up. Great Lakes Hardware and Auto. He's Mr. Handyman, so he kind of passed a lot of it down to me. And I like working with my hands and stuff and, you know, getting in there and twisting a wrench here and there. He takes his chances, lets the chips
fall as they might. Last question. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Everybody should own a good pair of dress shoes. I don't know, and a good suit. Everybody should own a good black suit.
Like a good sharp outfit.
A good sharp outfit. Impressions are everything, man. You gotta feel good about yourself. And if you got a good outfit, you're gonna feel good about yourself. That's so important, man. Confidence. Confidence is key. Yeah, that's the way.
If you, like me, are a little sick of heavy holiday food, you are the target audience for the vegan fast casual chain Veggie Grill. The company's raised nearly $250 million from venture capitalists and has been a success in California, Oregon, and Washington State. But can what works on the West Coast work across the country? The company is betting on it with a national expansion plan. Steve Healy is the CEO of Veggie Grill, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You all serve fast, casual, vegetarian food, and right now you're on the West Coast. How do you plan to expand nationally?
We're up and down the West Coast today from San Diego up through Seattle. But over the next few years, we do want to bring our brand to the East Coast and throughout the country, Midwest for sure and East Coast for sure.
Do you think that the rest of the country is ready for a vegan chain?
Absolutely. And the growing trend around vegetarian food and eating a veggie diet or plant-based diet or vegan, whatever, however you'd like to describe it, is a growing trend, especially in big cities. There's a lot of our core consumers clustered in those big cities.
When you think about your consumers, who are they?
Well, interestingly enough, yeah, we do attract vegans and vegetarians, but about 80% of our guests don't consider themselves vegan or vegetarian. They're what we call veggie positive. And so these veggie positive guests are guests.
Veggie positive.
Veggie positive, which means that these are folks that are mindful about how they eat and they've made a conscious decision to move veggies, grains, fruits, and nuts to the center of their plate. They could be flexitarian, pescatarian. They could just decide that, hey, I don't want to eat red meat. I want to eat more veggies. And I think intuitively people know that eating more veggies is good for you.
Well, this sort of brings up this interesting marketing question, right? Like, are you marketing around, hey, we have great food? Or are you marketing around, actually, this stuff is vegan? Because, you know, when you advertise a remoulade, you're not saying it's a vegan remoulade.
Sure.
You seem to be leaning more toward just, hey, this is the food.
We're a vegan concept and always will be. And I think our vegan and vegetarian guests understand that and they depend on us for that. But I think where we come from is we start out with, what do our guests want to eat today? And so we come at it from the food first. And then what we do is we engineer it so that it's vegan. So, you know, we do a lot of product development. We do 4 seasonal menus a year. So we're always looking for, what are the interesting flavors and foods that, you know, our guests are looking for, and how can we innovate and be creative and bring them things that maybe are really surprising that they didn't know that they could get at a vegetarian restaurant?
When you think about positioning yourselves, are you sort of aiming for the, you know, Panera slice of the market or the McDonald's slice of the market? Because they're very different things.
Very different. You know, McDonald's, I think, is mass market. So this is food that's inexpensive and you can appeal to a very, very, very broad audience. I think know, what Panera's done is they have broad appeal, but it's more for a more discerning guest that wants more of a fast casual experience. I think, you know, we consider ourselves what we call polished fast casual. Our food, it's not easy food to produce. So a lot of times it's on the edge of chef driven. We do have a lot of things on our menu that are very familiar to people, things like our Santa Fe crispy chicken sandwich. But from a quality perspective, starting with quality of ingredients and freshness, and everything's made from scratch, and we don't make the food till you order it. You know, we're aiming at more of the discerning guests that, you know, is very food conscious and wants high quality food, but they also want things that are familiar. So people can come into Veggie Grill and get an order of buffalo wings, and it's that great flavor that you expect from buffalo wings. But on a different occasion, that guest might order a quinoa power salad, which is very veggie centric. You know, I think we're sort of redefining a genre around our food.
How do you have high quality ingredients and sort of chef centered or handcrafted food and keep your prices down? Because your prices are pretty reasonable.
It's challenging because we use a lot of specialty ingredients. So they're naturally come in at a higher cost. And so, you know, it's always a balance of price versus quality. But we try to engineer our purchasing and supply chain and our vendor partnerships so that we can keep our food affordable and guests can, you know, come in a lot. And we do have a lot of highly frequent guests. So we're not inexpensive, but we're not overly expensive as fast casual goes.
You just raised $22 million in a recent funding round. What's the pitch you're making to investors about why it's a good bet to put money behind expansion?
Well, actually, a lot of our investors really understand trend. And the trend around plant-based eating, especially with millennials and the rising tide of millennial spending and, you know, vegan and plant-based and all that, which used to be on the fringe, is now going mainstream. So there's a lot of sort of critical mass going on around this movement to eat more plant-based items. You know, I think over the next couple of decades, eating this type of a diet, eating this type of food is going to be more mainstream than probably our carnivorous diet today.
But you don't put that into your pitch to diners, really.
We don't. I mean, we want to be all-inclusive. So sometimes you can attach labels to your food that people can misinterpret. So if you go to market and say, we're vegan, that for some folks, if you're vegan or vegetarian, you can say, wow, that's great. Other people that maybe haven't tried Veggie Grill or don't really understand our food might see vegan and go, oh, vegan, You know, some of that vegan stuff I've tried doesn't taste very good, or, you know, they tend to think about brown rice and steamed broccoli as vegan food or raw food. And so we call it veggie-centric because we don't want to exclude those folks that they just want to eat more veggies and they want great flavor and great food and they don't want labels attached to who they are and how they eat.
Part of your expansion plan centers around airports and university campuses. Why those places?
Well, actually, universities, we've been getting a lot of inquiries because the student population today has a very different perception of veggie-based food, and it's actually based on demand. So you have these student populations that are saying, we want veggie options. That's a big interest there. And then in airports, I think today's traveling consumer, you know, they're kind of tired of, and I run into this myself when I travel, trying to find something that is better for you and is flavorful in an airport can be challenging. So we think there's an opportunity to go into airports because those folks travel a lot.
When you look out at your expansion, who do you see as your competitor?
It's a good question. A lot of brands are now coming to market with better for you options. They're coming to market with a lot of vegetarian options. And we don't necessarily see that as competition. We see that as widening the audience for this type of food. I think what we do is very different than some of the other brands that have vegetarian options. We consider ourselves the experts and the innovators.
Steve Healy, CEO of Veggie Grill, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You just heard about vegan food, which fits in with how a lot of us try to change our behavior at the start of the year. Exercising more, eating healthier, kind of getting ourselves together. And there is no shortage of experts and businesses who want to sell you stuff to help you reach those goals. But often we ignore some of the most basic ways to get healthier. James Hamblin is the senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's also a doctor, and the author of If Our Bodies Could Talk, a guide to operating and maintaining the human body. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I actually want to start with one of these little graphics in your book, which I'm holding right here. It's like a food pyramid, but it's factors that affect health. At the top, small impact, clinical interventions. In the medium, preventative interventions. And then the biggest impact, the like sort of foundation of the pyramid, is socioeconomic factors. And obviously this is an economics show, so why is this big area down here?
Yeah, I think that idea, that pyramid, was based on something that was put out by the CDC, and it's an overlooked concept in our country where we think about healthcare as hospitals and pills and surgeries. But in fact, if you look at the research, most of what determines longevity and health is your day-to-day choices, which are heavily determined by your environment and what sort of opportunities you have, kind of food you eat, people you hang out with, where you live, et cetera.
So why'd you write this book then instead of just like a long treatise on economic inequality?
That's in the works. This book is framed around the structure of a health QA book, which is actually a common thing. There was a book in 2005 called Why Do Men Have Nipples, kind of answering body trivia. And so what I did was took that form and expanded it to show how social and economic circumstances actually factor into the answers to those questions.
Do you think that businesses, and particularly the sort of like embedded in our consciousness kind of American businesses, do they create conflicts of interest or bad incentives for us in terms of how we take care of our bodies? You know, I'm thinking Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And that's an easy example. But then let's say you have, you know, General Mills is trying to sell you different kinds of cereals. Like, how as a consumer do you sort through that stuff and figure out what's the best for you or your kids?
Right. I think if there is a simple rule, it's to not believe what food labels are telling you about health claims. At the end of the day, soda companies are still trying to sell you something that is more than water, and packaged food companies are trying to sell you something that is more than fresh fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and legumes and whole grains. And we really don't need anything more than that. So anything else is superfluous and or detrimental.
Wow. So you also have a section in here about something that I feel like comes up a lot. And I know from reading your column that you are particularly fascinated by claims around things like toxins and allergens. I'm curious why you think there's such an increased public consciousness of that, and whether anything like clean eating holds scientific weight.
The idea of a toxin is itself interesting in that it's a relative term. Water can be toxic when you are drowning in it. When you have too much of almost anything, almost any vitamin, almost any food, you will suffer health consequences. So it's easy for marketers to say that something is a toxin and then to sell you a sort of antidote to something that wasn't actually hurting you. As a consumer, you can say, why not err on the side of safety? Why not just take no chances, eliminate this thing, even if there's only a 1% chance of it being dangerous? So the threshold of them convincing you that something could be dangerous is much lower than the threshold of them convincing you that something is actually helping you. If they're selling you something positive, saying, this is going to do this, this, and this, it's harder to sell that than it is to sell, just play it safe and try this, and it might help.
A lot of the things that you lay out in this book feel to me like they, in fact, come back to the pyramid at the beginning of the book, because we as Americans are so primed for a clinical solution to whatever is wrong with us rather than a behavioral or socioeconomic solution for, you know, for our problems or whatever it is that's bothering us.
how do we make progress then to invert that and not expect a magic pill?
Right. It kind of comes back to fee-for-service medicine and people wanting a system that is structured to reimburse people for doing things, for writing prescriptions, for doing procedures.
And we should say that fee-for-service medicine, doctors get paid by the thing they do as opposed to, say, a flat salary.
Right. And they don't get paid for, say, putting a park into a neighborhood, starting a farmer's market. The financial incentives to actually keep people healthy are often at odds with the financial incentives to have people be sick and in need of the services that keep them from dying.
How would you fix that?
This is where I need my big treatise on economics. But if you look at the healthiest societies in the world, there is less income inequality and there is more equality throughout societies. So when you have people who are struggling, when people who can't meet their basic needs or can't get a good night's sleep, can't get access to good food, don't know how to interpret this onslaught of health information that's coming at them because they didn't have much education, then you see lifespans start to radically separate in terms of the wealthy people and the poor people and how long they live. And even in within the United States, there are places where within the same city, within Los Angeles, there is a 10-year life expectancy difference from one area of town to the next.
There are some interesting stories in here about the successes and failures of public policy in terms of how they change people's health. You talk about the war on poverty and a lot of things that didn't work. But then some of the outgrowths of, say, the Watts riots and a series of small health clinics that made a huge difference. But what are the models that we have seen where you can say, oh, you know what, that's actually a really good low-cost way to get medical care to people?
I talk in the book about this federally qualified health center, which is a program of clinics around the country which treat low-income populations. And there's this one that I profile called St. John's, which is in South L.A., which has specifically arisen to meet the needs of the transgender community. And what they try to do is improve the community around them. And this is sort of a trend that's spilling over into larger healthcare systems because as soon as you align an incentive for that clinic to not have people coming back every day, but to try to keep people happy and healthy, then you actually see meaningful improvements in the community. So St. John's is involved in helping people find housing, helping people find transportation to and from the clinic, helping people fill their prescriptions, taking on the full picture of health.
So, Jim, about a year and a half ago, I went to Brazil on a reporting trip. And as you know, I became terrified at the idea that I was getting bitten by a bot fly and was going to have a bot fly larva grow inside of me. And so I sent you – how many pictures do you think I sent you?
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, I recall a string of pictures and texts. They seemed to say that you were rather concerned about it. And I think you became kind of upset at me that I don't have expertise in that area and was unwilling to speak to that subject.
Yes, I was.
Subject, or unable to.
And I like to think that this book grew out of my botfly fear, that you decided to write an owner's guide to a human body precisely so that people like me wouldn't bother you with all of our questions.
That's basically it. So now when I have friends and family text me with any sort of questions, I can refer them to my book or just say, please buy my book.
Jim Hamblin, author of If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget to visit us at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez and Brian Allison are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Noren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.